listening to Maternally Yours, your conversation about pregnancy, childbirth, and early motherhood. Our program is produced weekly in sunny Sarasota, Florida at WSLR 96.5 LPFM, Sarasota's community radio station. Listen live on the radio, on the internet, on your smartphone, or at your convenience through our downloadable podcast at maternallyyoursradio.com.
Our mission is to support our listeners in growing empowered families that create empowered communities. Each week, we bring you evidence-based information for your journey through the childbearing years. We do not give medical advice, and with all subjects, we suggest that you thoroughly research your options and speak with an appropriate expert with whom you have a relationship of mutual trust and respect.
The voices you'll hear in the next hour belong to the Maternally Yours Collective and our guests, and do not necessarily reflect the viewpoints of this radio station, its board of directors, or station management. The conversation may include descriptive language or emotionally sensitive subject matter. We respect all families and understand that it is up to each of us to make the most informed choice possible. We are Maternally Yours.
We are Maternally Yours.
We are Maternally Yours. Welcome to the conversation.
Maternally Yours, your conversation about pregnancy, childbirth, and early motherhood. I'm Dana King, domestic goddess and mama to Elliot, cesarean prevention educator, and maternal mental health advocate. So tonight, everybody, you will be feeling like it's kind of quiet in the studio because I'm flying solo. Ryan tonight is watching her big girl graduate from preschool. So big shout out to my sweetheart, Jude, and congrats to the whole Shack Stan family. I'm sure you guys are having a great time. So in addition to hearing us live on WSLR each and every Tuesday, you can also hear us on WOL 91.5 FM in Bellows Falls, Vermont, KPOV 88.9 FM in Bend, Oregon, WCRS 102.1 and 98.3 FM in Columbus, Ohio, the Detour Network in East Tennessee, and Geneva Community Radio in the Finger Lakes region of New York State. So check your local listings for our time slot. And as always, you can also find us online at maternallyyoursradio.com or also on iTunes. So now here's this week's Birth in the News. Sudden infant death syndrome has been the cause of thousands of deaths each year, and now the cause of these deaths may be revealed. A study has been published providing significant evidence to point to the role of oxygen deprivation in sudden infant death syndrome. The cause of the syndrome has been difficult to study so far because of the many variables researchers needed to take into account, for instance, sleep patterns, what the infant breathes, possible illness, and other underlying susceptibilities. In order to isolate the effects of oxygen and the rate of sudden infant death syndrome, researchers from the University of Colorado compared the incidence of the syndrome in infants in high altitude to those closer to the sea level where the air was thicker. The results were shocking, showing that those living at higher altitudes were more than twice as likely to suffer from the syndrome. The authors also noted that infants sleeping on their stomachs and those exposed to tobacco smoke may also be at a higher risk, as it can contribute to hypoxia and insufficient oxygen reaching the tissues. Other studies have pointed to the possible link between infants sleeping on softer surfaces, bed sharing, and obstructed airways due to the infant's chin being shifted down, causing the infant to breathe less oxygen. So far, it's unclear how hypoxia may contribute to sudden infant death syndrome, but may aid in the buildup of carbon dioxide in the tissues. Around 3,500 infants die each year from sudden infant death syndrome, accidental suffocations or strangulations, and other unknown causes. Although the cause of sudden infant death syndrome is still unclear, evidence points to a combination of environmental stressors that occur at the time of critical development between the ages of 2 and 4 months old. Now, over in Sweden, we got some new information here. A fecal sample analysis of 98 Swedish infants in the first year of life revealed the connection between the development of a child's gut microbiome and delivery method. The study also found nutrition to be a factor in the microbiome development, specifically whether an infant is breast or bottle fed. Scientists are currently studying the role of gut microbes in metabolism, immunity, and even behavior. Gut bacteria are suspected to be a source of nutrients and vitamins for a developing infant. The study supports previous observations that the most early bacterial colonizers of the gut are from the child's mother. Researchers also note that while C-section infants receive less of their mother's microbes, the microbes are also passed through the skin and through the mouth. Once in the gut, the bacteria populations will shift depending on a child's diet. The authors believe that breastfeeding is significant because the microbiome development is aided by nutrients provided in breast milk. Concerns surrounding disturbances in a child's gut include antibiotic resistance, obesity, allergies, and autoimmune diseases. The disturbance may affect allergies in that antibiotics are a key gut bacteria that help immune cells mature. The authors also have developed a diagnostic test designed to calculate the developmental age of the baby's gut microbiome in comparison to healthy infants. A similar test could be potentially used by pediatricians to identify and treat infants who are more than a month behind normal development. The recent surge in cases of asthma, especially in children up to the age 4, has made researchers consider the effects of changes in the gut and airway microbiome as a possible contributing environmental factor. All the research remains in an early stage, but some and many believe that the manipulation of the airway and gut microbiome could lead to new strategies to prevent or manage asthma, which would be great. And last, but certainly not least, May 28th coming up is the International Day of Action for Women's Health. May 28th has been commemorated by women's health advocates and their communities since 1987 and has been crucial in the sexual and reproductive health and rights movement building. May 28th provides a great opportunity to remind our government leaders that women's health matters. This year's campaign underscores the gravity of ensuring that post-2015 comprehensively addresses women's and girls' sexual and reproductive health through highlighting the extreme consequences resulting from a narrow approach to women's health in the form of the institutional violence condoned and perpetrated by the state through the denial of sexual and reproductive health services and rights. Governments around the world are currently in the final stages of establishing the post-2015 development agenda, which will include a set of sustainable development goals that will guide the international development policies, priorities, and funding over the next 15 years. Throughout this and other recent global review processes, violence against women has rightly received due attention from governments and UN institutions alike as, quote, one of the most prevalent forms of human rights violations worldwide, constraining women's empowerment and impeding sustainable development. Yet one form of violence particularly experienced by women and girls if they are young, unmarried, poor, HIV affected, of diverse sexual orientations or gender identities, living with a disability or in any other vulnerable situations remains rampant and unaddressed. Namely, the institutional violence they experience when they are denied their right to health and are unable to access sexual and reproductive health services. So you can go to www.may28.org for more information. And if you have some birth in the news to share with us, send it to us by email at maternallyyoursradio@gmail.com or post it to our facebook.com/maternallyyours. And for links to all of our birth in the news stories, please visit tonight's epilogue on our website at maternallyyoursradio.com. So I know that was a lot of wordy news for everybody. Get your juices flowing. You know, tonight's topic is one that until recently I was not even aware of, which got my brain going thinking, this should probably be a show considering that you are just finding out about this, and now we need to let everybody know about it. So here we are tonight discussing secondary infertility. Our first guest tonight is Barbara Calora, who joined Resolve, the National Infertility Association, in September 2004 as the director, chapter, and Constituent Services. In April 2007, Barbara was named Chief Staff Officer of Resolve. As President and CEO, she represents Resolve at a number of national conferences, committees, and organizations, including the National Committee on the Oversight of Assisted Reproductive Technologies, the American Society of Reproductive Medicine, and the National Health Council. As the official spokesperson for Resolve, Barbara speaks at conferences and events on a variety of topics related to infertility. Barbara is passionate about Resolve's mission, as the organization was a source of support and information during her own battle with infertility. Thanks for joining us tonight, Barbara. Are you there?
I am here. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am. It's great to hear your voice.
Yes, thanks for having me on.
So let's start with the most obvious question. What is secondary infertility?
Well, it's interesting. There are different definitions, but the simplest, and I think for your audience and the lay audience, the simplest is when you have had a child or maybe even two children, let's say, and you had really no complications, no problems getting pregnant mm-hmm. with those births. And now here you are trying to get pregnant again. So again, it may be the second time or it might be a third time. And it's not happening. You are not getting pregnant. And it is taking you months and months and months, and you are not having any success conceiving. So again, it's somebody who already has a child, who had really probably no problems or no issues conceiving that first child, and now is experiencing great difficulty in conceiving the next time.
Got ya. Oh, gosh. All the research that I've been doing for this and everything that I've been finding out is, you know, proving to show what a complex issue it is when you already have the one child, is what I just read over and over again. How would a woman know that she is infertile? Is it just that she's trying to conceive and she isn't getting pregnant?
Yeah, so this is what's so perplexing about secondary infertility and why even the name and the definition are, I don't want to say controversial, but a lot of people don't know about, because they're going to automatically say, I'm not infertile. Mm. I have a child or I have two kids and no problem.
Right.
I don't have infertility. And so there's this misnomer that you are only infertile if it happened, you know, if you never, ever, ever could get pregnant.
Right.
So how will you know that you might be having problems?
Right.
You know, here's the thing. Let's put aside the actual definition and the name of it, however much we like it or don't like it.
Yes.
What we're in essence saying is you can't get pregnant.
Right.
And this is new to you, right?
Mm-hmm.
You don't know that there's any reason for this. So if you are under 35 and you've been trying for 12 months, you need to see a specialist. And that's not an OBGYN. That is a fertility specialist. If you are over 35, you only should wait 6 months mm-hmm. of trying to conceive. And you need to see a specialist. So it's really not that much time.
Okay.
If you go longer than 12 months and you're under 35, that's too long. You need to go see a specialist, and something is not quite right. And here's the, again, very frustrating thing. You're going to say to yourself, well, I'm healthy. My partner's healthy. We've already had a child. You would be so surprised at what they may find out, and how frustrating it may be. I mean, it may turn out that it's a miracle that you got pregnant the first time, or it may turn out that, you know, something has occurred, or that there's an underlying health issue with either you or your partner. Keep in mind, some infertility is unexplained, and that's, again, can be very frustrating, but I would get a referral from an OBGYN or a general practitioner to a specialist. They're called reproductive endocrinologists.
Okay.
And get yourself in to see one. They're going to run a battery of tests on both the male and the female that are going to tell them a lot of information, and then they can go from there in terms of what the next steps might be.
Got you. So how common is secondary infertility? And well, what about in the comparison to primary infertility?
Yeah, like you know, we don't have really great statistics.
Okay.
So it's a little hard because not all infertility is going to be treated using IVF. And right now, IVF, which is in vitro fertilization, every in vitro fertilization cycle in the United States is reported to the CDC. So we have very good information about those patients who end up doing IVF in terms of what their diagnosis is and what those birth outcomes were and if it even worked. But there's a lot of other ways that they treat infertility that has nothing to do with IVF. And we don't track that real well. So, for example, you may be put on a medication that just helps ovulation. Maybe one of these diagnostic tests comes back that, hey, you know, for some reason now you're not ovulating like you used to be able to. So they might give you some sort of medication. We don't know how many people are on that or, you know, what kind of outcomes they might have. So most fertility doctors have their own sort of statistics on this. It could be as high as 30%. Oh, of the patients they see have secondary infertility. So, you know, I take that anecdotal number that I hear from a lot of physicians, and that's generally what I use. But I will say that there is not a really good hard and fast statistic right now in the U.S.
Got ya. Can you explain a little bit about the complexity of what a woman and a family experiencing this particular type of fertility challenge might be having to deal with emotionally?
Yeah, this is a really, really, really tough one, and I'm glad you're doing a show on it and at least acknowledging that emotional strain. So imagine this, if you've never had a child and you're trying to get pregnant and it's not working, you know, it's awful, it's frustrating, it's devastating, it's what you've always dreamed of, and now it's not happening. Now picture yourself. You have a dream of having, you know, several kids or a couple of kids, and maybe fairly easily, who knows, you have that first child. And, again, no infertility that you know of. And now it's not working. And it's really hard for you to share your sadness and your frustration and your devastation because guess what people are going to say to you? You should be so grateful. You have a child.
Right.
Why are you complaining? Why are you so hard on yourself? Maybe this is just your fate. And so you have this horrible guilt of, gee, I shouldn't even be complaining. I shouldn't even be sad. I sound, you know, very ungrateful for the child that I have. And you become, I've heard so many women describe this, you become sort of with a person with your feet in like two different camps, you know, the mom camp and then the infertile camp. And to be quite honest, neither side really embraces you. The infertile group is saying, you already have a kid. Boy, what would I do? What would I give for even one? I've gone through years of infertility and spent, you know, $50,000. And then you go to the mom camp and they're all like, you have a kid. Why are you so sad and depressed?
Right.
So I think it's really awful emotionally. And I don't think that women appreciate that and respect that enough because they're not getting help. They're not connecting with other people. They're not getting support. Maybe it's seeing a mental health professional. But this is a really, really hard thing to go through. And I think incredibly hard to go through by yourself without talking about it.
Yes.
So again, think of that, you know, you're in two different worlds, neither of which is really embracing you and supporting you.
It sounds so very isolating. Can you speak to the stigma in general in society that surrounds fertility troubles and, you know, what's your perspective on what can be done to help that? Like you said, you know, these women are, they feel like they don't belong anywhere. You know, what can we do in our community to, you know, to turn that around?
Well, this has been going on for Resolve for 40 years. We were founded in 1974. So can you imagine going through infertility in the 1970s? So This is not new to our organization, and it's really why we were founded. We were founded to provide support and information to men and women who are living with infertility. And so this has been our mission and what we've been doing for 40 years. The stigma, the silence, the shame of infertility in general is a very big life crisis. There's been studies done that it's akin to a cancer diagnosis, the loss Wow. and the isolation that people feel. However, unlike breast cancer and even other diseases, people don't really talk about their infertility. And it's reproduction, it's about what happens in the bedroom, you're talking about body parts that nobody wants to share with their neighbor. So, you know, this isn't a big, hey, I'm posting on Facebook that I today got diagnosed with infertility. It's a big taboo. It's getting better. It's getting a lot better. But it still has tremendous shame and stigma. And part of that is because we as a society have very poor literacy when it comes to reproductive health. So people always assume it's the female. They always assume, you know, it's something you've done. It's your lifestyle. You work too hard. You're too stressed out. You exercise too much. Whatever the case may be, there's this blame game. Mm-hmm. And again, it's our ignorance when it comes to reproductive health. I hear over and over and over of people diagnosed with infertility who end up, you know, sitting down with their parents and explaining the birds and bees to their parents because their parents are like, I don't get it. Why isn't this working for you?
Oh, gosh.
So that's in general. That's for anybody trying to conceive where it's not working. And plus, depending on your situation, you might be getting a lot of pressure. You right. might be in a certain race or ethnicity or even religion where having lots of kids is valued and that's expected. Or maybe you're somebody who's a career woman and you waited and now you have this guilt of, gee, I waited so long. How am I going to face my parents and tell them, you know, I can't have kids? So there's a tremendous amount of that. And I think with secondary infertility, you have all of that and this, geez, I never saw this coming. I already have a child. That was so easy. This just came out of left field, and this is not what I expected.
Yeah, that feeling of being totally blindsided definitely seems to ring true in everything that I've read about it. What kind of other options are available for families that cannot conceive a second time but still feel like they're missing a member of their family?
Yeah. You know, here's the thing about secondary infertility. You know, if you want to support someone, the key thing here is to not be judgmental. Just because you're saying to yourself, well, gee, they should be happy with one, you have no idea what dreams and aspirations they have and how this is shattering to them. And so, you know, I think supporting them in that quest and in that journey is really important, and encouraging them that you're there. But also, you may say, you know, I'm not an expert in this. Do you want me to help you find a support group? Or, you know, maybe there's a mental health professional that has expertise in this, which, of course, there are. But I think when you start looking at family-building options, it's all of the same that exist for anyone else. I think what I hear oftentimes with people with secondary infertility is there's a strong desire to have a biological link. So, you know, they may discover that they need donor sperm, but they can still try and conceive with the female's eggs, or they may find they need to do donor egg, but still can use the male partner's sperm. Again, there'd be a genetic link to their first child. And then others may choose to try adoption. That's not for everybody. But certainly that's something that you oftentimes see and hear where maybe they don't have insurance coverage for infertility. They don't really want to go through all of the medical treatment, or maybe it's not accessible to them, and adoption is a more viable option for them. So there's certainly options. Certainly on the medical side, there might be surgery. I've heard of people with secondary infertility where they have endometriosis that just got progressively worse and became more difficult. You know, a lot of times surgery can help that. They mm-hmm. might be actually in early menopause. And so, you know, that as well, there's ways and treatments for that. And maybe IVF is the right option. So there's a multitude of things that can happen, and depending on what that is, and also what your own comfort level is and finances, that can help determine how you choose to proceed forward.
Now, you mentioned a couple of things going into my next question. What factors are known to cause secondary infertility health-wise?
You know, it's really, it's everything that really exists with primary infertility, which sounds crazy. But there are a multitude of things that could be going on. And you could say, well, gee, I didn't have any problem. And again, I've heard of this very often where things like endometriosis just progressively as you age just get worse, that you might have something called polycystic ovary syndrome, which is a huge cause of infertility. I think about 30 to 40% of infertility is caused by this polycystic ovary syndrome. So there's several things that can be the case. Generally, if you've had a child, something like a blocked fallopian tube may not necessarily be the cause, but something else could have happened. Even if you had had some pelvic surgery, maybe a cesarean, but something, you know, something else, or maybe you've had some other kind of condition that might have created some scar tissue that at the time did not in any way, shape, or form cross your mind that it would impact your future fertility. So
right.
It's everything that exists. You know, if certainly there were probably no sperm, there'd probably be very little chance that you would have gotten pregnant the first time. But stranger things have happened.
True story. Why do you think, or what have you seen, why are so many couples less likely to seek treatment for secondary infertility?
Because it never occurs to them. They all think that I had no problem the first time. I'm totally fine, and my partner's totally fine. We've proven that it works, that we can make this happen. And, you know, it's just some circumstantial thing. It's stress. It's this or that. And they delay and delay and delay. I mean, secondary infertility to me is the worst in terms of getting into a diagnosis quick and early, because there's such reluctance to admit and to think about it. And let's be honest, you got other things going on in your life. Maybe 4, 5, 6 months went by and you weren't even paying attention.
Well, yeah, that happens, especially when you're parenting.
Well, it does. And you hear this oftentimes with people like, well, I sort of lost track of time, and gosh, now it's been a year and a half, and geez, we've been so busy. And so, you know, I think with the differences with primary infertility, there's nothing else going on, and you're massively focused on this, getting pregnant.
Right.
And so there tends to be some of that going on where people just lose track of, my God, I've been at this now for 2 years. And I think that you need to be paying more attention. You need to know that this is a possibility. I mean, I hate to put more stress on people, but this is something that time is of the essence. And so the longer you wait for that diagnosis, the less options you may have.
Well, there you go. No other way to say that. Can you tell us more about Resolve and the work that you guys are doing over there, and maybe any resources that you have to offer for women and families that are struggling with infertility?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, our website is resolve.org, so resolve.org. We have a fantastic website. We also
Yes, it is.
What's that?
Yes, it is. I learned so much just starting there.
Oh, good. Well, that's great to hear. We have a really strong, robust online support community, and you can find it a link to it from our website. We actually partner with a third party, and what's great about that is that there are different communities as part of that huge online community. So if you're going through secondary infertility, you're not stuck with people who are adopting, or, you know, you're going to be with like-minded people in your secondary infertility group. So the online support community is great. If you have access to a live support group and that's something you think might be of interest, Resolve has hundreds of live support groups that meet around the country every single month. So these are, you know, small groups, maybe 8 to 10 to 15 people. They'll meet some in people's homes, but maybe a public library or, you know, some other community space. And they'll meet for an hour or two once a month, and you'll be with people just like you. And I think if you're looking, you want to be looking for that secondary infertility group. If all there is available is just a general infertility, you may just want to talk to the host, and this is another volunteer,
okay,
and let them know your situation. And we want you to feel very comfortable going, and you might want to just ask a few questions about, you know, the types of people that are there, and if they think somebody like yourself going through secondary infertility would feel comfortable. And then check out our website. We've got a lot of great resources. So we have support groups. We do a lot of legislative advocacy at the federal and state level. We also have something called National Infertility Awareness Week, which happens every year at the end of April, and it's the only federally recognized health observance for infertility. So we work very, very hard to raise public awareness about the disease of infertility.
Fantastic. Well, I can't thank you enough for joining us tonight, Barbara, and getting our brains filled with all this information. And I look forward to seeing what is coming from Resolve in the future.
Well, we would welcome being on your show again. We consider ourselves experts on all things infertility, and it can be a very complicated process. So we'd love to join you again, but we're so grateful you did this story. It's really important.
Thank you so much, Barbara. Have a great night.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You are listening to Maternally Yours, your conversation about pregnancy, childbirth, and early motherhood. When we return from a short break, we'll continue the conversation about secondary infertility with writer and mother Amy Rubel.
A lot of people are so illiterate when it comes to that word. And they act as if it's a crime if a woman don't have a child. But I don't think so. I don't have a child. I may one day. But in the meantime, I'm going to share my love. Child, don't make me any less than a woman, 'cause I got so much love to give to so much unwanted kids. Say all you want about me trying to ruin my reputation, I still got so much love to give to so much unwanted kids. Listen to my song. I may not know the joy of giving birth, may not experience the child. And if pain is pain, then I'm hurting inside. If infertility make me less than a girl, what would you say to many women in this world? Would you tell them have faith? Would you tell them be strong? Or would you tell them that they're less than a woman?
You're listening to Maternally Yours, your conversation about pregnancy, childbirth, and early motherhood. You can find this and all of our recent podcasts on our website, www.maternallyyoursradio.com. where you'll also find an epilogue including any resources and links we mentioned in tonight's show. So let's continue our discussion about secondary infertility now with our next guest. Amy Rubel is a parenting writer who contributes regularly to Lifetime Moms, Mom.me, Momtastic, and the Huffington Post. She also blogs at carriagebeforemarriage.com, where she wrote about her struggle with secondary infertility. She is now the mother of two daughters, a four-year-old and a newborn. Welcome to Maternally Yours. Amy, are you there?
Thank you. Yes, thanks for having me.
Yay! Man, this is like one of my favorite things ever that I always geek out on, is that I get to read writers' writing and then talk to them. I just think it is the coolest thing. So I'm really excited.
I'm happy to have any readers, so that's great.
Oh, man, I've been reading your stuff for a little while, and when I thought about doing this show topic, it just kind of clicked in my head. Ding! Remember that scary mommy article you read so long ago that made you laugh and then cry? And it was you! So tell us a little bit about, or a lot bit if you want, about your journey with secondary infertility. You know, how were you diagnosed? What treatments and what therapies did you try out?
Sure. It was quite the odyssey. You know, with my first child, we had a little trouble, you know, getting there, but because I was on the older side. They call it advanced maternal age. Very flattering.
Mom.
So I had a couple of early miscarriages, but we were able to conceive naturally and very quickly. So I thought, you know, if we start again right away after having that baby, mm-hmm. There shouldn't be any reason why it wouldn't happen twice. And I think a lot of people assume that if you can do it once, you can do it again. Right. And I was wrong, at least initially. After about 6 months of trying really hard and having nothing happen, I got nervous because my clock was running out. Right. And I went to see a reproductive endocrinologist and got tested for everything. And there was nothing seriously wrong with me in terms of fertility issues other than the fact that I had declining egg quality due to age. But because it was so important to me to try to have a second child before it was too late, I wanted to know that I had tried everything. So I said, okay, sign me up. What do we do first? And, you know, I followed a pretty typical path. We tried IUI, which is insemination. When that didn't work, I moved up to the hard stuff, which is IVF in vitro, which is not easy. And we actually did 3 rounds of that totally unsuccessfully, which I was shocked. My partner and I were both, you know, thinking, surely it's going to work one of these times. And each time, it wasn't like a flop. We had fertilized embryos to implant, but none of them took. And, you know, I was throwing everything at this problem that I could think of, everything that anyone suggested, acupuncture, you know, exercise, messing with my diet. I went to see an energy healer. I mean, you know, anything I could think of. And what finally wound up happening, that's my baby in the background.
I'd love to hear that.
You know, it's interesting. I don't know if any of your listeners, you know, who are having secondary infertility are in my boat, which is that they were dealing with, you know, older eggs and declining egg quality. But what our doctor finally said was, he said, I think what I'm seeing with you when we do these procedures is your eggs they're kind of old, they're kind of fragile. When we take them outside your body and tool with them in the lab, like, they don't like that. It's making it worse. They're disintegrating, they're falling apart. He said, I really think that your best bet is the old fashioned way. Which is surprising to hear from a doctor because, you know, wasn't gonna get our money anymore.
Right.
But turned out to be correct.
Huh. So there you go.
Yeah.
So, wow. In your journey with secondary infertility, you were super public and open about your challenges, you know, writing about it on your blog and all these other different areas on the internet. You were even, like, on television. I saw your little clip. You
sure.
were on the news and everything. Did you find that healing for you, or did it sometimes kind of add to your anguish at times?
Yeah, it was a mixed bag. I mean, on the one hand, having a creative outlet to vent feelings was terrific. And not having to suffer in silence, because it wasn't like this secret I was keeping. It was the opposite. It was, you know, I was telling everybody, I was writing about it. I was talking to strangers about it. You know, so on a good day, that meant this feeling of, you know, support and people around that you could talk to. But it also opened the door for people to ask whatever questions they wanted at any time. Mm. And sometimes, you know, those questions were not what I wanted to hear when I was going through something that was hard for me. Like, you know, why don't you just adopt? Or, you know, why aren't you just happy with the one kid that you have? You know, mm-hmm. and you're already dealing with these feelings of guilt, and then you have other people kind of adding fuel to the fire.
Kind of feels like you're getting poked with a stick over and over again. I can
imagine. So when you you know, so when you share, you it's good, because you shouldn't go through things like this alone in life, but you also kind of open yourself up to, I don't think people even know that they're doing it, but they're inadvertently kind of criticizing you.
It's life in the public eye. That's just how it goes, right? You're supposed to take the good with the bad, or whatever people say. One of the things that Barbara mentioned when I spoke to her earlier in the show was, you know, what we talked a little bit about stigma, you know, surrounding infertility in general. But, you know, she was just said specifically with secondary infertility that they deal with a lot of couples who are just in such a kind of almost like a state of massive denial that they have any issues or problems, because clearly things worked because we had this first child. So I can only imagine how, you know, I don't know, how aggravating and frustrating that must be how did you ensure that you don't kind of like isolate your daughter that, you know, you already had and loved so much, even though you were still, you know, internalizing or yearning for another child to add to the family? Like, how do you cope with that?
Yeah. You know, luckily, you know, at the time my child was very young and probably wasn't all that aware of what I was going through. Might have seen me cry a couple times, but it's not terrible for a kid to learn that, grown-ups have
feelings.
you know, and she would go with me to all my appointments and literally sit on my stomach while I had transvaginal ultrasounds. I can't tell you how many times we did that. You know, so it's, you know, having a child already when you're going through any kind of infertility struggle, it's interesting because on the one hand, thank God you have this child, and I do think primary infertility must be much worse than secondary infertility, but it's still very real, and they get big enough and they start asking you, you know, mommy, when do I get a little brother, a little sister, and to not be able to tell them with any assurance that they're going to have that, it breaks your heart.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah. That's heavy. It could be because you want to deliver everything for your child. You want to give them everything you never had, everything you ever thought about having, everything you wanted.
Absolutely. And when you think about what's important in life, it's not important getting them a car when they turn 16. It's important,
right,
you know, giving them a loving family. And yes, parents is where that begins. But I was very conscious of wanting to give her a sibling for a couple of reasons. One being that I grew up with a brother who I adore, and I wanted her to have that kind of experience. And also just being an older mom, you know, my husband and I, we can't help but think about the future and just wanting to know that she'll be taken care of, you know, emotionally, that she'll have those people that are her forever family close to her, because we're older. So it's too morbid to say it out loud, right?
I know what you're saying. We're not going to live forever as parents.
Yeah.
We're not always going to be here. And you want to know that they have somebody to be with when you are not here anymore.
Right.
Yeah, I totally get that. That's definitely, it is a morbid thought, but that is a totally like logical mom thought right there. It doesn't get more real than that.
I was very high up on that.
Talk to me about guilt. The guilt of the
note. So much guilt, and moms have no shortage of guilt, regardless of whether they're dealing with any kind of infertility, right?
Ding, you are right. You know, like,
so then you mix in some struggle. You know, I think you definitely feel guilty about, you know, why isn't one enough, and will my daughter pick up on this idea that I'm unhappy somehow with the size of our family?
Right.
Especially if you know people in your life who have not been able to have one child for whatever reason, and here you are whining about, oh, I can't have two, you know,
right.
You feel guilty about, you know, wanting too much or not being satisfied with what you have. But, you know, the heart wants what it wants. And I think that our desire to grow our family to have a sibling for our daughter was, you know, definitely coming from a really good place. But yeah, I still felt guilty.
Did you ever experience that feeling of kind of not really belonging in any one place? Like, you kind of, you know, didn't belong with the mommy camp necessarily because you wanted to have another child, but like you said, oh, you already had one kid. Like, what are you, greedy? And then you didn't really belong with the infertility moms because, again, like, hello, you still have one child, and why are you frowning so much over there? You know, it seems so complex to
no, definitely.
Feel like
because
you don't
I was
fit.
Blogging and putting a bit of a public face on the journey, I would even feel guilty about that because, you know, I became almost this poster child for secondary infertility, and yeah, I was on our local news and it was everywhere. But meanwhile, I, you know, had this beautiful daughter, and, you know, how dare I compare myself to someone who, you know, never gets the experience of having at least a biological child. And definitely you're caught in the middle a little bit, but you don't want to minimize people's struggle because the feeling is real.
That's right. Absolutely. What about a support system? Did you know other women who were also experiencing secondary infertility as you were going through the process, or
you know, I didn't then, but I do now. Through the blogging, so many people reached out to me, which has been great. And I made a bunch of online friends, and I've sat back with joy and kind of watched as they eventually, a lot of them did get pregnant through various means, some their own, some, you know, donor eggs, all different ways, and it's just been beautiful to see. And then, you know, people in my own life who were keeping this stuff under wraps, once I became really vocal about it, felt more comfortable opening up to me. So then I found out that I had friends going through it, didn't even know they were going through it, especially because they were much younger. My mommy friends, it's not based on how old we are, it's based on how old the kids are. And
right.
So even though I'm in my early 40s, I've got, you know, lots of these mommy friends in their early 30s, and it surprised me that they were going through it too, and who knows why. Sometimes it's a mystery.
Right. Yeah.
But it's definitely more common than I ever knew.
How do you cope when it seems like you're at the playground and every woman there is pregnant and you're not? Did you ever feel jealous of other women?
Oh, yeah. No, and it's no exaggeration. When you're, like, you know, I've got a preschooler. So when you have a preschooler and you're socializing with preschool families, like, they're all pregnant. And if they're not pregnant, it's only because they're already carrying a small baby. And it's just like, it just smacks you in the face every day.
Right.
And, you know, I didn't want to, like, oh, I'm going to hide from these people and just, you know, ignore them or not go to their baby showers. But that's not my personality. And I love babies, and I'm happy to hold other people's babies. But, yeah, of course, I was deep down and brutally jealous. And you can be both at the same time. You can be happy for other people and caring towards them while inside just, you know, dying. And I was.
Man alive. How did you deal with the feeling that your family was felt like it was missing somebody and going through the process of grieving over the idealized version of the family that you thought you would have? I mean, did you ever have that moment through your journey where you thought, I'm just going to have to be happy with what I have and move on?
Yeah, because if you don't come to terms, you can bring down your whole family and your relationship. And I didn't want to do that, and that's not worth it. So, you know, I started trying to come to terms with it by, one thing I did was I talked to a lot of friends that were only children about their experiences, because that was not my experience. And, you know, universally, they were fine with it. It's what they know, being an only child. And they told me about, you know, ways that they made really close friendships that were like, you know, having a sister or having a brother, and it definitely helped. Another thing that I did, which was almost like to unjinx myself, but it also, you know, helped kind of with the healing, was I started giving away my baby things, finally. I was like, you know, holding on to these is doing me no good. And I handed down my daughter's clothes, and I handed down the toys. And, you know, that's almost like a recipe for getting pregnant, which is pretty much what happened.
Yeah, exactly. And lucky you, you happen to have two girls and you got rid of all that girl stuff.
I did. I mean, people were really cut. Some of it came back and people, you know, people have been great. And it doesn't, obviously that's not what's important is the stuff, but
exactly.
it was funny.
Yeah, yeah. What can you say about the... I mean, sometimes for some people, I know you said you did three rounds of the IVF. What about the enormous financial burden that can come upon a family that's struggling with infertility?
Oh, you know, it's terrible. I mean, it's so mind-blowingly expensive, and most, well, I guess some insurance plans cover some of it. Mine certainly didn't.
Right.
You know, I was extraordinarily lucky because we just had a lot of family support, and my parents got involved, and we couldn't have done it without them. So it didn't break us, but I really feel for other families where, you know, it must be awful to know that the one thing that might be able to make it happen for you is just out of reach. And I think that happens a lot. I know of a woman who wound up having to get her IVF out of state. And so she would, I don't know how she and her husband did it, but they would have to like travel and stay in these motels, and it's already such a stressful process, but
wow.
At least she was able to do it. But there was something about going out of state that made it cheaper. I don't know.
Wow. Yeah, it's definitely that feeling of desperation that you'll go through whatever links
required. Oh, you'll do anything. Yeah.
Yeah. Who cares? I will take more debt. That is fine. I need my baby. How did you and your partner cope through all of this together? Yay.
I think in any kind of, you know, struggle with fertility or fertility treatments can take a toll on, like, the strongest of couples. It's rough, and there's so many reasons why. I mean, you know, you're dealing with just, like, getting your hopes up and then getting them dashed, and just constant feelings of loss and disappointment. And even though, like, the woman is going through the physical end of things, which is no picnic, he's still going through this emotional roller coaster every month, and it's hard on both of you. And it's hard to not get on each other's nerves and fight, especially when I know for me, like, I'm on all these hormones, I'm shooting myself up in the stomach every night, and I'm moody as hell, you know, and cranky and just bloated, and I put on so much weight while I was doing that. Like, the IVF is no joke. But even without the fertility treatments, it's just such an emotional roller coaster. And then, you know, are you ever going to be exactly on the same page? Like, I wanted this. I would do anything. And he was probably more able to be content with our family as is. Like, he'd be happy to have a second child, but didn't need to go to the ends of the earth in the way that I did. Mm-hmm. But he was willing to support me on that. But I think it made it hard on him that I was just pushing so hard.
Wow. Yeah, that's fantastic that he was there to support you, though, and, you know, could...
Yeah, he's a good dude.
He must be if you did the carriage before marriage thing, girl. Hey, I love how you're always talking about him, your baby daddy.
It's actually kind of a bummer that we did finally get married, and now he's just my husband. That sounds so boring.
It's not as fun to say.
No.
How disappointing. Look at us complaining. So what do you, I mean, you mentioned a bit about your doctor and his advice. What do you think was your key to getting pregnant with your second daughter after all that time of struggling?
I mean, there were a couple things I would say were at play, because you never really know.
Right.
And that's why it's so hard. You want to give other people advice and be like, this is the answer, but it's a big mystery. You know, for us, definitely making the assumption that only fertility treatments could do it for us, it was probably a wrong assumption. Mm. I don't really regret trying, because I just, you know, if it hadn't gone our way, then I would have always wondered, what if, you know, we should have tried. But looking back, I mean, we were much more successful with conception when we were just trying naturally. Because, I mean, I had, over the whole period of time of having two kids, I had about 6 miscarriages. And they were all they were natural. They were not through fertility treatments. Mm-hmm. And through the fertility treatments, I didn't even have a single conception. So that should tell you something.
Hmm.
So it was just surprising that sometimes nature is actually a little bit stronger than medicine. Not for everybody. There's so many fertility problems that are that can really only be handled through medicine. But declining egg quality, not necessarily.
Right.
If you want a couple more things, I did do fertility acupuncture for a year leading up to this baby, and I think there's certainly a chance that had something to do with it. The acupuncturist I work with, he would be, you know, kind of negative every month. Not negative, but like, he'd look at me like, you know, we still have some more work to do on you. And I never knew what the heck he was talking about. Right before I got pregnant, he said, he told me it was about to happen for me.
Oh.
And I thought, oh, is he like a wizard? And he was right. So that makes me think that he knew something.
Oh, man. He was working hard with those needles to open you all the way up.
Maybe. The last thing I would say, and this is like, this is obnoxious advice, but, you know, when you're having trouble, people always say, you just have to relax and then it will happen, right?
Uh-huh.
And that's rude because, like, first of all, how are you supposed to relax when this is the most stressful thing that's ever happened to you? And,
right,
you know, you don't want to think like, oh, yeah, it's my fault. That's why I'm not pregnant, because I'm not relaxed. Like, that's not fair to women. But, in my wacky life, we were right before I got pregnant with my second child, we were planning a wedding. And I got extremely distracted for the first time in the whole infertility journey that had been, you know, almost 3 years long. I just couldn't focus on it anymore. I was planning a wedding. I was trying really hard to get into my dress. I was losing weight. I was exercising. I felt fantastic. And I wasn't looking to see when I ovulated anymore. I was just like, I just put it aside. I'm like, we can't deal with this until after the wedding.
Mm-hmm.
So is there any surprise that that's when I got pregnant?
Well, go figure.
Yeah.
That little type A brain, you just put it towards something else, and then the magic just occurred. Huh.
It's possible that had something to do with it. just not being so crazy about it for a little while.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know how you give that advice to someone,
well,
but I think
I
about
mean,
that.
I think that that's something you commonly hear, though, is that, like, the moment that you're not thinking about it anymore is when the thing happens, and that's not just for fertility. That's for, like, any sort of, you know, magical thing that happens in your life. What kind of advice do you have for other women out there that are struggling with this secondary infertility?
Yeah. You know, I would say that it's worth it to go see a doctor. You don't have to commit yourself to this journey of these very expensive and intense fertility treatments. Sometimes it's just good to get tested and find out what you're up against, because you might have something that could be fixed really easily, you know, with a dose of baby aspirin or with just small changes without even having to do anything invasive. So, and I think people sometimes are too afraid to go see a doctor, almost like afraid of what they would find out, or afraid that they're going to be like handing their credit card over that day and that's going to be, you know, the end of their dreams of buying a house. But I think it's worth it to just, you know, get a good workup. And I would also say, you know, to not be afraid to talk about it, that it helps, that you'll find out that you do have friends that are going through it also. And not, you know, not keeping it this dirty secret is I think, better.
I agree. How old is your baby now, Amy?
She's 7 weeks.
Oh, my gosh.
She's sleeping through this whole radio show, which is amazing. She's right next to me.
Oh, man. Well, we have a studio baby, Ryan, my co-host. She's not here tonight because her daughter just graduated from pre-kindergarten today. But, yeah, her little dude comes and hangs in the studio with us all the time. It's really fun.
That is fun and appropriate for your show.
Exactly. Well, congratulations to you and your family. I'm so glad that you had a triumphant ending to your story.
I hope that helps somebody. It can happen. We never gave up, but we did give ourselves some breaks, and I think breaks are good. Vacations are good.
Absolutely. Can you tell our listeners where they can read more about you and what's going on with your world and in the life of parenting?
Please do. Please come to carriagebeforemarriage.com and check out my blog. I write about all kinds of parenting stuff. Most of it's pretty funny, or I like to think so, but you can also dig through there into the archives and find the whole story of what we went through to have the second baby. And you can find me, I have a Facebook page for Carriage Before Marriage, or on Twitter at CB4M. Would love to have you stop by.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us tonight, Amy.
Thank you.
Have a great night.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, everybody, that's about all the time we have. What do you know? For tonight's episode of Maternally Yours, we'd like to thank everyone who makes the conversation possible, especially our listeners and guests, Barbara Calora and Amy Rubel.
You've been listening to Maternally Yours, your conversation about pregnancy, childbirth, and early motherhood. Produced at WSLR 96.5 LPFM, Sarasota's community radio station.
Our volunteer hosts, writers, and producers are Ryan Stanley, Laura Gilkey, and Dana King. You can find our most recent podcast at maternallyyoursradio.com, where you can also contact us with your comments, questions, and stories.
Until next week, we leave you with the words of Dr. Maya Angelou. When you know better, you do better. Thanks for joining the conversation.